Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I ask my guests to reveal the five things from any time in their life that they would like to preserve in a time capsule. Well, four things they cherish and wish to keep safe, but also one thing they rather wish they could banish from their life, something they want to bury in the ground and never have to contemplate or own up to again. My guest in this episode is the actor Alex McQueen. Having gained a first degree in English at Durham University and then a master's at Pembroke College, Cambridge, Alex trained as a barrister at the Middle Temple in London. Fortunately for us, this sign of great intelligence didn't last forever, and he became an actor. And he's been doing it pretty much full-time ever since. He was the anaesthetist, Keith Green, in 75 episodes of Holby City, and the advisor to the Prime Minister in the political satire The Thick of It. He's also been in over 40 films, including The Hide, In the Loop, A Very British Cult, Four Lions, The Inbetweeners Movie, Youth, with Sir Michael Caine, Gambit, Jack the Giant Slayer, Cinderella, Slaughterhouse Rules, and Horrible Histories, Rotten Romans. On TV, he's been in Peep Show, The IT Crowd, Casualty, The Wrong Door, Lead Balloon, Outnumbered, Miranda, Black Mirror, This Is England, Hunderby, Plebs, Peaky Blinders, Silent Witness, The Durrells, and The Trial of Christine Keeler, to name a few. So, if you haven't noticed that Alex is ubiquitous, it's because he's so good at looking right in every role he plays. I am delighted to be able to bring you the five things that Alex McQueen would like to put in his time capsule. Lovely, Alex. We're going to put some things into a time capsule. Five things from your life. That's all.
Yes.
All right. So what do you think you'd like to put in first?
I think I would probably put in the entire Carry On collection. I think the Carry On films have always been something that I've responded to with huge affection. Yeah. I'm well aware that they have a variety of, the spectrum of quality is vast. There's probably about five or six that I think I would happily watch to this day, and I still do. I do. I really enjoy them. Yeah. But they do. The reason I would put them into the capsule is because they're close to me for the following reasons. One, It always reminds me of Christmas, I think. The Carry Ons and Christmas were sort of hand in hand when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. partly because we didn't have a TV when we were growing up. We didn't have a TV in the house. It was just a sort of policy that our family did not have a TV during the school term. So the local convent would give us the TV that belonged to them for the Christmas holidays. So it was this tremendous gift, basically, of fun that would arrive at Christmas. And the carry-ons were something that I equate with that era hugely. So it reminds me of my childhood Christmases in part. But also, it really was one of the reasons why I thought I wanted to become an actor. It wasn't because I thought, oh, look at the quality of these performances, even though actually I think they are really, really great in comic terms. But I couldn't quite credit the fact that grown men and women were making a living and making money out of being so damn stupid. So that's really what I thought, well, if that's allowed, if that's something one can do with one's life, I must try and do it.
The fun of it, you could see the fun they were having.
Precisely, yes. There was the sheer physical fun of their performances, but also these were the first shows I was watching on telly, and I couldn't believe that people got paid to do that. I didn't know it existed as a sort of living, I suppose. So the carry-ons were quite an instrumental piece of my development, I suppose, if that's the right word, in inspiring me to want to become an actor, I think. So that's why I have a very close affection for them as a brand, in particular Kenneth Williams, at his peak powers. He's a genius in here, really. I think, I mean, he's sort of seen as this crude vaudevillian, but he's not at all. His ability to fire through with thousands of emotions very quickly during one sort of performance is, it's outstanding, I think. Yes. So I think because he's so funny and because he's sort of so silly, we don't recognise the fact that there's a huge amount of technology behind that that is really, really precise and absolutely first class.
You spotted that as a child then. Do you think you actually spotted those details? Because it is a very detailed performance, isn't it?
Well, no, I couldn't claim, I suppose, as a child to have thought, oh, I know why he's a good actor, because he's got all... No, it was just, I suppose I just responded to the fact that it was such a colourful performance. Everything he did was so... There was such a lot going on. I find that fascinating. And I also find it fascinating that he's not viewed in any way, in shape or form, as a sort of Gielgud or an Olivier or a Ralph Richardson or anyone like that. And yet, his impact is, I would say, potentially far greater, and that we still... He looms large in the minds of people to this day in a way that your Ralph Richardsons, etc., might not really. And I think he'd be absolutely thrilled to look down and see how he is still remembered, and he's on television all the time, so...
And sadly, towards the end of his life, he clearly didn't think that. He felt that he was fading away and nobody cared about him. Because it's a very tragic end to his life, really, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it's very sadly ironic that he never really felt the pleasure of the impact he had on people, I think.
No.
Yeah, so the carry-ons, and in particular Kenneth Williams, they really did make me want to become an actor. And certainly, if not become an actor, certainly not have to work for a living, if you know what I mean. If people
yes,
can
I
have
know.
That much fun, I'm going to have a part of that, definitely.
Well, would you say, though, that your parents... in the act of not letting you have a television through term time, did a good thing or a bad thing? Did you then come to Christmas when the nuns gave you the television and just never leave it? Just satiate yourself with them?
Absolutely. I would do 12-hour stints in front of this magical box and loved every single second of it. I mean, the only things that would be desperately boring were when my father wanted to watch the news. That was always seen as a dreadful, dreadful, why would you want to watch the news? But I'm very grateful that we didn't have the TV on reflection, because I think it made it a treat when it came round, obviously. But I think it also restricted our viewing habits into we weren't watching everything all the time. It was metered doses, I suppose, of material. And that made it more potent, perhaps. I don't know. What I will say is I wasn't happy at the time. to have to see it go back at the end of the sort of Christmas holiday and not to be able to interact at school with my friends who were watching TV programmes and talking about Doctor Who or The Bill or whatever it may have been, I sometimes found that a little bit sort of, well, certainly frustrating and a little bit isolating, perhaps. But in terms of the balance, I'm really pleased we didn't have it as a sort of routine. It had a special, it occupied a special place, I suppose. Mm. So that's, I'm fundamentally grateful for that. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. Certainly it made the Christmas holidays seem special.
It was, it did. It had a profound impact. I can remember, yeah, watching Towering Inferno and all sorts of things as I think about it now. But yeah. So that's the world of the Carry-Ons, I would say. And the
yes, we'll definitely put the Carry-Ons in there.
Please, thank you.
Do you have a particular favourite?
I love the medical ones. I think stupidity and medicine are a great combination because the stakes are clearly high. And, yeah, the medical ones occupy my favourites, but I really like the Khyber, Carry-On up the Khyber, and I like the toilet one, the W.C. Boggs. I like that one. Carry On Cleo, yeah, yes.
If they were making them now, Alex, you would definitely be in them.
That's... I wish they would. I wish they would make a sort of a franchise of comedy farce, basically. The need for farce and that sort of physical comedy, I think, is way overdue, actually. Just the joy of being silly.
Yes.
The joy of silliness, I think, is due a comeback, because a lot of comedy has been sort of quite dramatic in a way. It's sort of, there's a lot of angst attached to quite a lot of comedy these days, and I think, yeah, a return to some full-on silly could well have a place. Yeah, I agree.
I've always liked full-on silly.
Yes.
Okay, right, we will put the lovely Carry-On films into your time capsule.
Great.
That's the first item. So what's number two?
Number two, I think, would have to be my barrister's wig.
Oh, yeah. You're fully qualified, aren't you?
Fully qualified, yes, but I haven't practised for about 20 years.
No.
But, yes, I became a barrister back in, well, yeah, 20 years ago, and I was very grateful for having the skill set that I sort of learned doing it. And I'm very grateful that I had mentally this sense of a fallback if acting didn't sort of work out. I'd always wanted to be an actor from very, very early days, even at sort of almost at nursery. I remember my first, not an acting experience exactly, but we had to do an exercise where we all had to do our morning routine in terms of putting on pyjamas and having breakfast and all the rest of it. And yeah. I remember taking to it with a real, just loving every second of it. And that was basically sort of performance, I suppose. And it was since that moment, I think, I've always had a desire to be an actor. So it was, so it goes back deep into the sort of earliest parts of my life.
Yes. And I suppose a barrister is about as close as you can get, isn't it, really? Although it's much more serious. If you're going to stand up in front of a jury and perform, it's important you perform well and correctly, because somebody's liberty or wealth are at stake.
Totally. No, absolutely. But I was very grateful for the world of the bar, because I was very nervous about trying to become an actor for a living. I knew that actually doing it to pay off your mortgage and all the rest of it is a very sort of risky activity. So I went and joined the world of the bar as a sort of, not exactly as a backup, because actually I went into doing it with every expectation of practicing as a barrister and doing it for a living. But it didn't... Yes, it didn't work out. I wanted the particular branch of law I wanted to be in was defamation.
Oh.
And there's a very, very, very discreet area of the law. There's only sort of two sets of chambers that really do it.
Mm.
And I thought, if I don't, that's the world I want to be working in. And I didn't manage to get the pupillage that you need at one of those two sets. So I did my pupillage at a couple of commercial places, and then went to work, as it happens, in entertainment law. I began, instead of doing defamation, I did a bit of entertainment law. And I remember sitting in my office and looking out the window to see Orlando Bloom turning up to the premiere of Lord of the Rings, because I'd been in the National Youth Theatre with him a few years before, and I saw him turn up in this huge great limousine and this big premiere, and I could see his the poster of his face sort of looking at me from the other side of Leicester Square, because my office was actually in Leicester Square. And I thought, no, I have got to give this a go. Yes. I mean, I'm not suggesting in a million years that his pathway was my pathway. I'm just saying, hang on a minute. I knew him 4 years ago. I've got to at least give it a go. So I resigned, I gave him my notice. And then I basically was rather fortunate in meeting a casting director about 3 months later who got me my first job in a film and then got me my first agent. So, yes, that was my sort of route into becoming an actor.
Two professions, though, Alex, that, a pupillage as a barrister is not the best paid job in the world, is it?
No.
No. And then you go into acting where, to begin with, it's almost certainly not even paid.
Totally. No, I mean, I often feel guilty because people say, oh, my gosh, what a huge risk you took giving up being a barrister. But actually, it was zero risk because, A, you're not earning very... I mean, it would be much more difficult to have gone into acting having done a sort of 15-year career at the bar and had a healthcare plan and a pension.
Yeah. Shall I be a QC or shall I be an actor?
Right. The writing was on the wall in some ways with being a barrister because you have to do 12 dinners at the inn of court that you belong to. So every barrister belongs to one of the four inns of court. Mm. And I belong to the Middle Temple in London. And during the sequence of dinners that we have to participate in, I managed to find myself... It probably was stress related, but this ball of rice as part of this chicken supper was not going down my gullet. It was stuck in my throat. And I was like, during the dinner, I was trying to pretend to have a conversation. All the while, my throat was panicking and sort of creating this flux of saliva and all the rest of it. And eventually, I thought, well, I'm going to have to go and get this sorted out at a hospital. So I left the dining room, got into a cab, got taken to A&E in St Thomas's, and eventually this rice ball dislodged.
Mm.
But there is a slight postscript to this, which is they said you must go home and you should go and visit your local A&E department where they can do what's called a barium meal. Mm. A barium meal is where you swallow some radioactive porridge, basically, and it photographs your insides to sort of see what constriction was occurring in the throat and all the rest of it.
Mm.
So I had this sort of concrete, this radioactive concrete supper. Everything was photographed. And I went home that night to my parents' house, thought nothing of it. But at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I thought, oh, I need to go to the toilet. I need to get rid of this radioactive concrete, which I did. I flushed the toilet and left, and that was fine. But my father went in just before he went to bed at about 3 a.m. because he's a night bird. And he went into the toilet and he looked in to the base, into the U-bend, and he could see these pieces of broken concrete. So he assumed, oh, my gosh, the U-bend is collapsing. I need to sort this out. So he, without a second's thought, put his bare hand straight into the U-bend, only to find it cascading into some radioactive materials. So, yes, the writing was rather on the wall, really.
On the wall, if you couldn't make it through one dinner.
Yes, I couldn't make it, exactly. So I would put my barrister's wig into the time capsule because yes. I was very grateful for it as a skill set. And it's very useful to sort of have as a comfort blanket, I suppose, in terms of if all else sort of dried up and stopped. And I have great affection for the mental discipline of it. I really enjoyed the intellectual discipline of the world of the bar. So so that would definitely be something. I've still got the wig. It's in a tin. It's in a tin. Yeah,
a black tin, the one you used to carry it in.
No, I never bought that. I was because I mean a barrister's wig is about it was about £350 back then, 20 years ago, and so getting the tin would be a sort of another £80 or something. I can't remember what it was, but it would have been expensive. So I never had the tin. I wish I did, but nevertheless, I never did. So
no, quite right. Well done.
It's in a biscuit tin. Yeah,
it's only to weed out the people who don't come from the right families.
Precisely.
Well, he couldn't afford the tin.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not quite one of us. Is it still in good condition?
It is, yeah. It's in very good condition, partly because it was very rarely used. I mean, I was in the High Court quite a few times doing what's called winding up petitions. So I would go in every Wednesday. So I did have the ability to use it quite a bit. But they're rare now. Even in, I think only in criminal trials do they actually have wigs now, so it's being phased out, which I think it's a pity, actually, because I think it lends a sort of dignity to the whole proceedings, but it also is quite useful, especially for criminal barristers, in terms of anonymizing them.
Yes.
I've got a friend who's a prosecutor, and he said he's sat on trains back from court where defendants have sat in the same zone, and they've not recognised that it's the same guy that's just been prosecuting them in court because he wore this wig. So it's quite a... I think they should be preserved, personally, but...
Yes, I can see the problems of it, that actually you become rather imposing.
Yes.
And can intimidate people. But in a way, that's sort of part of the job.
It's a costume that, you know, the police wear a uniform because it's... In part because it is a costume, it's a symbol of authority or whatever. So, yeah.
Well, the wig is going in.
Great.
But it's not the gown, because those gowns are almost impossible to keep up, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
Lovely. Okay, that's into the time capsule. So we've got two things.
Okay.
We've got Carry On and your barrister's wig. We're jumping about, which is lovely.
We are.
Right, it's time for a short break for an ad now. We'll be back in the time it takes to have a very short break.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, sorry if that turned out to be a slightly longer break than you expected from a short break. These things are out of my hands. But I can take you straight back to Alex McQueen and the rest of the things he wants to put in his time capsule. So I'll do it now.
Did you have a think about the thing that you'd like to get rid of? Either an event that you felt was unfair or unjust or something, you know, which is quite
often... Yes, I'm trying to think if I ever felt I was unfairly treated at school. The truth be told, I think I was disciplined at school.
Mm-hmm.
For because I was, in the school reports, it says he was a disruptive influence in class. So I think, in fairness, I can't claim it would have been unjust, because I was in my first school... my prep school, I wasn't allowed to eat with the rest of the class because of my behaviour was so sort of off the wall.
That's quite a punishment, isn't it? To be isolated at lunch.
I was isolated, I mean, not every single day, but I do recall being... Basically, I sort of did life in many ways the opposite way round, in that when all the children at school were very well behaved and very good. I, in my sort of 5 to 9 period, I was, I was a disruptive, naughty little boy, I think, basically. But then when everybody turned, when we all became teenagers and everyone around me became a bit more naughty and a bit more outrageous, I became a goody-goody and a well-behaved. So I did it sort of in reverse, I suppose.
Yeah.
So trying to think how I would describe, what item I would put into the capsule to sort of capture my school era.
Were you sporty at school?
No, not in a million years. And that's just as an example of the stupidity and naughtiness. If I was forced to participate in a football event, for example, I would be put in goal and I would almost invite the other side to score goals while I was in there. So I was a menace. So, yes, that's a good example of my reckless behaviour at school, I suppose. So just returning, though, to what I would put in to capture my school era. But at my pre-GCSE school, I suppose, I don't know what that would be called now, but anyway, my maths teacher was gravely disappointed in me as a child, gravely disappointed, to the point that when my mother came to the parents' evening, my maths teacher stood at the top of the staircase and she said, "Are you Mrs. McQueen?" And my mother very proudly said, "Yes, yes." She said, "I'm not talking to you." So that was the level of how much I was not a star in that regard. However, we then did an end-of-term school play. It was Pyramus and Thisbe. It was the sort of play within a play in Midsummer Night's Dream. And I played Bottom in that. And it was the first time I sort of acted in front of the school and with others. And it went down very, very well. And I remember this teacher, Miss Stacey, coming round backstage afterwards to give... Well, she couldn't help but praise it. She was finding it very peculiar, because normally she would be giving me the most almighty tellings off. And on this occasion, she was full of excitement and praise and was, I mean, she did at the end say, I just wish you would put as much care and attention into your maths as you do this acting. So I do recall, A, the feeling of popularity, and B, the feeling of being redeemed, I suppose, by doing this play and it working out, that probably had quite a sort of intoxicating effect in terms of, gosh, well, if this is the outcome of just messing about, because in my head it was just a bit of fun, this is a good thing to be doing more of, I suppose. So that school play, Pyramus and Thisbe, I would put that into my capsule, actually. Pyramus and Thisbe, just because it's written into my forehead in terms of the change that it caused in my fortunes at school, I suppose.
Yes.
That's the best way of putting it.
It's interesting, isn't it? But there's a strong possibility in my mind, listening to that story, that actually your maths teacher clearly felt you were capable of being really good at maths. And as she said, if you'd only applied yourself.
Yes.
So maybe her frustration and her annoyance with you was, I know this boy can do this. He's just not doing it because he can't be bothered.
Well, yes, he's either that or just supremely distracted in the head. By which I mean, I think, looking back, I think if I do apply myself to stuff, then I can achieve sort of an outcome, basically. But I do find it a struggle, and I always have. Sort of focusing for more than 20 minutes at a time has always been difficult for me. And I think, just remember, especially this is partly why I like scripts and stuff, certainly for TV and film, is that it's very disposable. What you have to learn and remember is basically for that day. So, and I suppose also, as a career, you're permanently given something new to do. Any job lasts a few days and then you're on to the next one. And I think that really does appeal to my slightly exhausted or exhausting mental attitude to things, really. It works well for a mind that's a little unsettled and hungry for new sweets all the time. Yes.
But interesting that you were able to will take control of the complex details of the law of defamation, which is that's not easy.
Well, the truth be told, the thing about the law is it's not very difficult. It's just there's lots of it. I think a lot of the concepts, especially in criminal law, basically all crime falls into two categories: don't fight and don't cheat, but don't be violent and don't be fraudulent. It's ultimately not that complicated, or it's not difficult. It's just there's so much of it, you could get very easily lost in the forestry of it. So that it takes a mental confidence, I think, more than anything else, to be able to hack your way through all the irrelevant stuff that's out there legally. So yes, it's not difficult, it's just there's lots of it.
That's true. I do remember that from my own studies, that when I did my degree, Basically I put case law everywhere, stuck it up everywhere.
Did you?
Yeah, all over the house. So for months, as I walked around the house, in fact, my wife, who was then my girlfriend, would shout from other rooms, cases.
Really?
Johnson's versus the Crown. And I'd say, 1947, it was
Gosh.
So I treated it rather like learning a script, I think, yes.
Right.
You're right. It was just a lot of things to put in your head.
There's a lot of it, but it's not actually all that. Oh, my gosh, this is... It's definitely not chemistry or maths. I do not have a mathematical mind, that's for sure.
Well, then she was wrong. You couldn't have done it.
Miss Stacey was... I mean, it would have been misplaced. Her enthusiasm for my ability was misplaced.
Did you ever nickname her Miss Stakey?
I like it.
Do you see where I've gone? Yes.
But we used to call her Starch, because she would wear quite starched clothes. And this was her nickname at school. Anyway, she'd threatened to call up my parents because of my just poor quality at maths. And this had been going on for a few weeks, this threat to call. And eventually she did call the home. And my mum answered, and she said, it's Miss Stacey. So my mum ran through to my dad and said, oh, Johnny, it's Starch. Starch is on the phone. And my father then went to the phone and picked it up very sort of dignified. He said, hello, Miss Starch.
Oh, no.
She said, it's not Starch, it's Miss Stacey. So anyway, yes, that was revealed.
Lovely. Well, then we should put Pyramus and Thisbe into the time capsule for you.
Let's put Pyramus and Thisbe into the bargain. Yeah, that's good. Okay.
Good. So that's three lovely things we've got so far. Then what's your fourth item?
Two possibilities. Mm-hmm. One, I mean, this is really an experience, I suppose, of realising, I suppose, how lucky you are. But I go to Lourdes in the south of France once a year to sort of work in a hospital there for a week, looking after people who are very sort of poorly. Mm. And I think in terms of the memory of that, I would want to put that into my capsule just because it was incredibly valuable in resetting 15 years of, frankly, self-obsession and what's the word?
Being an actor.
Being an actor, basically. Yes. I suppose we have to be ambitious and driven, because otherwise you won't be able to pay your bills and all the rest of it. So you've got to, if you're going to run your own business, you've got to be quite determined, I suppose, and be fearless in pursuing an opportunity, I suppose. Mm. But that can easily tumble into sort of self-importance and self-obsession, I suppose, quite quickly and easily. And especially in our particular kingdom of acting, it's very, very easy to be plumped up into sort of a sense of far more importance than you actually earn or are entitled to.
Indeed.
Just in terms of the way we're treated, you know, we're picked up in these sort of chauffeur-driven cars to take us to sets, etc., etc. And it's very easy, I think, to suddenly become wrapped up in the funfair of it all and think, oh, yes, what I'm doing is important and all the rest of it. And I think going to Lourdes and working there, even just for the week, was an incredibly valuable moment in resetting just how, A, lucky I am. Just to be able to walk, frankly, yes, from one room to the other is like, oh, wow, I am seriously lucky to be able to do that, let alone all the other wonderful things we have going for us in life. And also just to remind oneself how important kindness and compassion is. There are the people who I was working alongside out there, the real sort of the actual nurses, the nursing staff, the fact that they do what they do so selflessly and for such little reward in some ways compared financially, I'm talking about, made me think, gosh, I've forgotten just how lucky I am, basically. So I think my experiences in Lourdes, sort of observing how other people look after people and how kind they can be and how compassionate, is really, really valuable, especially in a world where we, in my world, where we can become very, very, as I say, self-obsessed.
And did you choose Lourdes because of a religious belief as well?
Well, yeah, so I'm Catholic by background, and that goes in peaks and troughs of devotion. Sometimes I'm highly sort of devoted, and other times I'm always a little bit more sort of questioning and sceptical. Mm. But it's in my DNA, as it were, in terms of it's something I've been brought up with from day one, and I take huge, huge comfort from it. I divorce religion and faith, they're two separate things, really. Mm-hmm. My faith, in some ways, is much more important than my religion.
Yes.
My religion is just the sort of useful means by which I can experience that faith or yes, basically.
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, if you're going to see the two extremes of Catholicism, Lourdes is a great place to see it, isn't it? You will see the excesses of iconography and things like that.
Indeed.
And then the wonderful, as you say, devotion of people.
Yeah.
My mother was a nurse and a Catholic, and she went to Lourdes regularly.
Oh, did she? Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
Often on hospital buses, so she would go with extremely ill people to go to Lourdes. But she also had a great, an absolute faith in the fact that going there might produce a miracle.
Yes, I mean, it's very delicate. That's a very delicate sort of path we have to tread, as in, no, we don't say to people, come, because if you come with us, you will walk away healed. Mm. We would never, ever do that in a million years. But the spiritual, I don't know what the word is, just the spiritual colour you get from going there, and the just the levels of love and kindness can last you for the whole year, basically. You can bring it back with you, and you just, yes, it really does reset the way you treat other people and how so few things are actually all that important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the context of what you see out there, I went along actually in some ways with sort of my own worries about, I suffered quite a bit from OCD and things like that. And I went along thinking, how the hell am I going to be able to shower somebody? There's no way I can go into a toilet and have to look after someone in that regard. That's just going to do my head. I can't do it. I certainly can't wash someone's teeth. And then on my second day there, I was forced to just because of the circumstances, to have to help someone, albeit with another nurse, in a shower scenario, which went terribly badly wrong in terms of functions and all the rest of it. And it was, I couldn't have, all my OCD fears could not have been more pronounced and exaggerated as a result of that. But as a result, I have to say, that aspect of my life was very much calmed.
Mm.
The whole OCD issue was very much reset, actually, because I was thrown into a scenario where, yes, I was forced to confront these demons, as it were, that were in my head.
How interesting. So you go somewhere with the aim and the intention of going because you think, well, I need to do something for somebody else. I need to go and help someone. I need to show some kindness in my life.
Yeah.
And then you go there and the effect is on you.
Oh, totally. I feel a bit guilty because people say, oh, gosh, what a good thing to do. But no, I actually got more out of it and get more out of it than I give without a shadow of a doubt. And I feel, you know, I do feel sort of, oh, gosh, that's not how it's meant to be. But actually, a lot of the people who go there do come back and they feel they've got more out of it than they've actually given.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a really wonderful experience and a wonderful place. And, yes, socially, it's brilliant too. I mean, we work very hard. We have to work, we're up at, we normally go to bed at about 2:30 in the morning. We're up at 6:30 for the shift. Yeah,
wow.
So, so that's the world of Lourdes. So I would put Lourdes into my capsule, I think.
Yeah.
Is that what I was saying?
Yeah, basically? Absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
The trips there.
The trips, yeah.
But Lourdes is a place. I mean, why not? It is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? I mean, as I say, it has that ridiculous contrast of over-commercialism.
Totally.
And yet, this extraordinary effect on people.
Yes,
I've seen both sides of it. My mother's come back with the most ridiculous things.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Stuck them on the wall, you know, and thought they were gorgeous.
Great.
But at the same time, she came back absolutely exhausted, having spent, you know, 2 weeks hardly sleeping.
Yes.
And I don't think it's because she was staying out having a drink, particularly. But it might have been. It might have been.
Yes.
I hope it was. And yet completely refreshed as a person.
Yes.
Marvellous.
I'm glad we spoke of that. That's great.
These things are inadvertent sometimes.
Yes.
Strange connections between people, the thing that you would never know. There have been several things you've said today where I sort of go, no, I absolutely understand that world. My father had offices in the Middle Temple just round the corner from the main square.
Oh, really?
Yes, we're just outside the hall, you know, where the pond is.
I know, exactly, yes.
To me, Christmas is walking through the Middle Temple and the man lighting the gas lamps.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
They still have those gas
lamps.
Don't
they just?
Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yes, we've found these amazing connections in all sorts of areas.
Yes, we have, sir.
That's
yeah.
Lovely. So we've got one more thing to put into the time capsule.
One more. Well, my final item would be a red telephone box outside the English department at Durham University, because that is really how I managed to become an actor proper, or rather, not proper. One should never say a proper actor, get a grip. But yeah, that's how I got into it, basically. So I was in the National Youth Theatre, and I was doing a production of Julius Caesar with Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Mm.
And I had a tiny part. I had 10 lines at the very beginning. And for the rest of the show, I was pretty bored, bored stiff. And backstage one night, I was flicking through one of the props. It was Julius Caesar's sort of paperwork binder. And as I was flicking through it, I realised that they'd stuffed the prop with carbon copies of letters sent to the famous patrons, Sean Connery, Roger Moore, all sorts of people, John Gielgud. And I looked at these addresses and thought, now, hang on a minute. They could be very, very useful to a person. And I was just about to go to Durham University.
Mm.
And I thought, when I get there, I would definitely want to put on my own play. So I tell you what I'll do. I'll make notes of these addresses. And I'll write to them when I get to university and say, could you help me? Could you give me some money?
Yeah.
So that's what I did. So that folder was shut. I went to Durham University and I wrote to the various people. And some of them responded very, very kindly. John Gielgud sent a check for £100, etc., etc. But a couple of other people did not respond so well. And they forwarded my letters to the National Youth Theatre and said, what the hell are you doing giving out our private names and addresses? So the National Youth Theatre wrote to me and said, we've had these complaints. You should now consider yourself an ex-member of the National Youth Theatre.
No.
So I was basically expelled from the National Youth Theatre. So for 3 years at Durham, I was not in the NYT. Anyway, at the end of my experience at Durham, I was thinking, what will I do? What will I do with the summer that's coming up? I tell you what, I'm going to audition again for the National Youth Theatre. I'll just give it a go. So I rang up the National Youth Theatre from this telephone box outside the English department. And I got through and I said, oh, are there any places available for this this summer's show? Can I audition? And the voice on the end said, is that you, Alex? And I said, yeah. She said, oh, it's me, it's Sam. It was a friend of mine from the National Youth. She was doing some work in the office. She said, oh, well, lovely to hear your voice. What a treat. Listen, I tell you what, we are actually completely booked up, but pop down on this Saturday and we can fit you in at the end at 6 o'clock. You'll be fine. Come down. I said, oh, that's brilliant. Thanks so much. And I put the phone down. Anyway, in the office was the manager who'd sacked me. And he said to my friend, was that Alex, as in Alex McQueen? And she said, yes. He said, oh, no. Ring him straight back and tell him he's not to come and he's not welcome. But because it was a red telephone box, there was no way of actually returning the call. So I still went down to the audition on the Saturday. I messed the audition up in terms of forgot lines and messed up my props, but this was perfect for the part they wanted me for, which is Rodrigo in Othello. So I was given the part and all was forgiven. And it's because I rejoined the National Youth Theatre that I got my first agent, basically. It was because of that that I managed to get an agent. That red telephone box is quite a... I have a huge affection for it, because if it hadn't been for that, I may not have... I certainly wouldn't have got back into the MIT and...
No young actor will have that. No. The mobile phone, they'll be straight back onto them. How awful.
Totally. Yeah, so I would put that into... I want that in the capsule, that red telephone box, yes. It saved my bacon.
Definitely. It's absolutely brilliant thing to put in there.
Yeah.
I was just explaining to my grandson just the other day, we walked past a red telephone box, and he said to me, "What's that, Grandad?"
Oh, really?
I said, "It's a telephone box that used to go in there to make phone calls." And he, of course, looked at me as if I was mad, because why would you take your phone into a box to make a phone call? That's what he imagined.
Yeah. Yes.
The only thing I know about Durham University is that you were never stupid enough to run across the bridge.
Elvet Bridge, I think. Is it Elvet Bridge or Kingsgate Bridge?
You're supposed to climb onto the parapet.
Incredibly dangerous and would result in probably death if it went wrong. Yes. I didn't do it. No, definitely not. Yeah. No, I loved Durham. I have to say I was very lucky to go there. I loved it.
Beautiful.
Really good fun. In fact, that red telephone box, I'm very pleased it goes in, because it connects me to those 3 years there, which were... I hate to say, they're the best years of your life, because everyone's lucky if they've got a heartbeat going for them. But there was something so nourishing and rich about that era that I still, it still drives me to this day, actually. It's a battery pack that I sort of take with me throughout life in a way.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, because as you get older, I suppose all experiences become, there's less that's new. Whereas at that age, at between 18 and 21 at uni, everything is exponentially new, and it's such an exciting time. Yeah.
Fantastic. And there we are. Well, I'll put that lovely classic red telephone box into the corner.
Yes.
And of course, you can make other phone calls from it. It's a very useful thing to have.
Thank you. That's great. Yes.
Well, there we are, Alex. It's been really gorgeous talking to you. Really interesting.
Oh, splendid.
And lovely to discover these connections that we've had.
Yes, I know. I'm delighted too. I had no idea. So thank you very much.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule. So, sorry if for some reason you were expecting an audiobook of Far From the Madding Crowd. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest was the lovely Alex McQueen. If you enjoyed it, then you can subscribe to this podcast on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do rate or review the show if you get the chance. And you can follow me or My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And the theme tune is available in full on Spotify. It was written by Pass the Peas Music. This has been a cast-off production, and the producer was John Fenton Stevens. If you didn't enjoy it, ignore everything I've just said. You can't subscribe, and there's no way you will be allowed to underrate us or leave a crap review. It's against the law to follow people without their permission. And the theme tune is by Law Protected. And I've no idea who produced this thing. In fact, I've nothing to do with it. All right? Now, get back to your tedious audiobook and leave me alone. Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.